And now, the Great American Folk Show, a little place where we commune with you to share stories and sing some songs and talk to some good people with great voices. Juno Award-winning singer-songwriter Lynn Miles is on the program. She's got a great style, and her voice cuts deep. Fellow Canadian singer-songwriter Jennifer Castle is also on the program, and she is right on time to offer a prayer to California. Plus, we're going to have a visit with a mortician in Warren, Minnesota. Victor M. Sweeney lays it out nicely. Also, banjo devotee Evie Layden will get old-timey. I'm Tom Brusso. We've got an incredible show for you today on the Great American Folk Show. A couple years ago, the Americana outfit Jackson Pines was on the show from New Jersey, showcasing folk songs from their neck of the woods. They've been busy releasing two albums since 2023, another album of New Jersey folk covers, and an original album of material. Whether diving deep into Jersey's music annals or contributing to the modern singer-songwriter songbook, their makeup is what I'd call a great combination. Enjoy Jackson Pines.
Talk to me. Help me see the things I cannot see. Help me be the man I could not be. Even when I'm gone, walk with me like the steps and carry on with me. Shoot the moon right through it used to be. The place where I was born many years ago. For times were hard and work was scarce, I had no choice but go. But I've been back there many a time, and in my memory of all the places I have seen, there I'd rather folks we used to know. Times have changed and they were gone a long, long time ago. But the scrub pine, the ground oak, the berry bush and sand, they never change, they never will. Pine barrens land. Forgotten towns that failed the test of time. Sometimes they're a long way. Granite markers, cold and gray, aren't the only ones who stayed there in the barrens. The
Jackson Pines with the Pine Barrens song, written by New Jersey's own Merce Ridgway Jr., and before that one they composed entitled When I'm Gone. I love that tune. It's the Great American Folk Show. Welcome, I'm Tom Brousseau. We're going to keep the music going right now with Evie Layden, a talented dancer, Fulbright recipient, and a student of the banjo. In fact, she's dedicated her life to it. I'd go so far as to call her an authority on the banjo. Her live session begins now with a tune called Pretty Little Dog, and then she's gonna talk to you about what it means to be old-timey. Thank you.
Hi, this is Evie Layden. Thanks so much for having me on this show. I started playing clawhammer banjo when I was 8 years old, brought into it by John Cohen of the New Law City Ramblers when he was staying with us, as we often housed folk musicians traveling through when we were living in New Jersey or Baltimore or wherever we lived. And I currently live in Oakland, California, and am continuing on with a career playing and teaching clawhammer banjo along with percussive dance and old-time harmony singing and body music and all kinds of things. But the clawhammer style comes right out of Africa, where there are a number of instruments with a short string, and the thumb on that short string, on the fifth string in this case, provides very unusual kind of offbeat to the music. And as the music evolved in this country, that clash of black, brown, and white cultures in the American South, with the banjo from Africa meeting the fiddle from Europe and the English language and meeting the polyrhythms and the tonal systems from Africa, and of course also mixing with the native influences in that area from the get-go, created what we call old-time music, the first mixed American music that is so foundational to so much music that came out of that. And a lot of people associate the banjo with bluegrass. And bluegrass is a more commercial version that evolved with the development of radio and putting the music on the radio. But old-time music in its natural habitat is often for your own pleasure or for dancing, and is extremely rhythmic in nature. When a lot of people play old-time music, it's all about the groove. I think of it as trance music. People really get knee to knee and they play a tune over and over again. Some people think that, you know, in bluegrass you improvise and in old-time music you don't, but that's not true. In old-time music you improvise as an ensemble, and always listening to each other and playing high or low or adjusting to have the syncopations that you share with the fiddle player and all of that. And I've been writing songs since I was in middle school, a little embarrassed because I grew up with traditional music and was shy about, you know, putting my songs out there. But then I started doing that, and most of my albums were original music. But in that I teach clawhammer banjo, my students were saying, which of your records are most traditional? And none of them were. So in my years of traveling, I started recording fiddle and banjo duets with fiddle players that I love to play with all around the country, and started creating these Riding the Rooster albums. And I just put out the second volume, and each volume has 17 different fiddle players, and just playing fiddle and banjo duets of just some of the best tunes. They're great compilations. All the rest of my albums involve original music and sometimes mashups with traditional tunes, like you'll hear on this track. Thanks for having me.
Sometimes I can, and sometimes I can't, and I can't without you by my side. The sun is shining all around, but it's not shining on me. How long will you stay in this town, or will you come, go, come, go with me? Will you come, go with me? Demand. The sun is shining all over. They filled up my bed and my head filled with glorious dreams. Glory, wind in my hair. Glory, sun at my heels. Glory, shadows are lengthening down. Glory, the world, come go with me.
Evie Layden right there with a song called Glory, and before that, another one entitled Pretty Little Dog. Thanks for listening today. Glad to have you here. This is a great American folk show. Around the office, we just call it Gaffes. I'm Tom Brusseau, and I hope your day's been a good one. You know, I love it when people write in. More and more people are doing it, so I think more people are listening to this program now. And I'm so glad for that. And you can write me, too, anytime you want to. I'm going to give you my email address. It is official, tombrusseau@gmail.com. And I got one the other day from a listener, Georgia, describing herself as a podcast listener. And Georgia writes, I love that you highlight great Canadian performers. Well, I do, too, Georgia. She continues, a while back, I caught your segment on Farron. I was delighted. Keep up the good work. Nobody does it better than you. P.S. Canada is tops. Well, Georgia, thank you for writing in. I couldn't agree with you more. Literally and figuratively, Canada is tops. It is right above us here in North Dakota. In fact, North Dakota is kind of referred to sometimes as Southern Canada. But thank you for writing in. As it just so happens, Georgia, we're going to be featuring two of Canada's best on the show, songwriters Lynn Miles and Jennifer Castle. So let's go to Lynn first. Lynn Miles is a songwriter that I dearly admire. I have to say that right off the bat. And I have been listening to her for a long time. She was on a label that I just love called Red House. They're out of St. Paul. Didn't matter what they put out, I always bought that record. And lo and behold, one of those records was Lynn's. Her album, Love, Sweet Love, from 2006, was with me on many long drives when I was touring regularly. And the title track I want to play a little bit right now has such move to it.
You're living in the city, you're cool as you can be. The future looks like roses as far as you can see. You got a perfect life, you got a perfect.
Lynn Miles is a Juno Award-winning songwriter and professional touring artist from Canada. And she's been in the game for many years, and she continues to do excellent work. She joins us now with a live session. Here's her introspection composition entitled, A Heart With Its Light On.
Stronger than anger, hope can be bigger than fear. Kindness can cure hatred or change the story in the atmosphere. And it's okay to not be okay. All this madness makes the edges fray. To get past this night and make it till dawn, try to find a heart with its light on. It's easy to say, it's harder to do. To not lay down, to push on through. All the more reason when it's so dark to try to turn the light on. It's okay to not be okay. All this madness makes the edges fray. To get past this night and make it till dawn, try to find a heart with its light on. Imagine all the the little hearts that have their searchlights on to give the weary and the broken hope when every hope seems gone. And it's okay to not be okay. Madness makes the edges fray. To get past this night, make it till dawn. Try to find a heart with its light on. Go towards the hearts with their lights on.
Hello, I'm Lynn Miles, and I am thrilled to be with you on the Great American Folk Show today. I'm recording this from my home in Ottawa, Canada, and I'm just checking out the weather app here. I know it's a cold weekend in your part of the country. Where I am right now, it says it's minus 10, but it feels like minus 18. I have no idea who decides what it feels like, but to me it feels like it's minus 100. That's in Celsius, so it's really, really not that cold. Anyway, first song I sung here today is called A Heart With Its Light On. And I wrote that because I feel like we're going through a rough patch in the world and that there's a lot of bullying and meanness and mean-spirited people out there. And I just think that to get through these kind of times, we really need to keep the light on in our hearts and try to find the other people around us who feel the same way, who have kindness in their hearts and are gentle and looking out for each other. And so the second song is a song called Merle. And I wrote this because I went to a show, went to see Merle Haggard, and my friend was opening the show. So I got to go backstage and I took a friend of mine who at the time was suffering with a brain tumor. And he had been like the biggest Merle Haggard fan in the world. So he got to meet his hero, and I watched them have a great conversation. And at one point, Merle took a Sharpie and signed his forehead. And he said, "Son, you've been dealt a bad hand." And I thought that was such a Merle Haggard thing to say. And when I wrote this song a couple years ago, both Merle and my friend Joe had passed away. And I was thinking about both of them. And thinking a lot about Merle Haggard and what a great artist he was. He was a triple threat. He could sing and play and write amazing songs. So we lost one of the greats when he passed. And so the song is called Merle, and I hope you enjoy it. And thanks again for having me on the show. Take care of yourselves.
Silver wings and swinging doors, bright lights and barroom floors. There's a heart that can't be healed on the streets of Bakersfield. A heartache voice and twinkling eye. There's a new star in the sky. No more darkness, no more pain. He's riding on that freedom train. It's too hard to say goodbye. The tears still haven't dried. All wishes were denied on the day Merle Haggard died. Day Merle Haggard died. The good times are really over. The bottle's gonna let me down. He can't sing me back home from the lonely side of town, from where the lights are
Support for the Great American Folk Show comes from the John and Elaine Andrist Charitable Trust, the estate of Blair Flegel, the Lorac family, First State Bank of Golva, and Minn Kota Power Cooperative, helping meet the electricity needs of rural member cooperatives in eastern North Dakota and northwestern Minnesota. Our power is our people. More information at minnkota.com. You're listening to the Great American Folk Show. I'm Tom Brusseau. The next segment talks openly about death and dying. We'll be talking to someone who is trying to make the subject less scary, less taboo. But for younger or sensitive ears, the topic may be a little too weighty or triggering, so we just wanted to give you a little heads up. Now, I got a recommendation to check out the videos of Victor M. Sweeney. I'll tell you about him in a second, but this recommendation came from an artist who's going to be on the show probably in February. Her name is Alicia Spilde, and she's from Carlstead, Minnesota. And she told me I've got to check out her friend's YouTube page, and I could not believe what I saw. She said, check out my friend. He's an undertaker. And that's a word that you don't really hear so much about anymore. Maybe you read about it in like an old book of something, like a Shakespeare story. Mortician, you hear lots about morticians, but an undertaker, not so much. And I think it's because mortician's not as ghastly, maybe, of a heading And don't we all just like headings that seem to take away the emotion? Neutral headings. Anyway, Alicia gave me a link to this Undertaker's video where he describes the embalming process, and over 3 million people have viewed it. And the second link she sent was entitled, Mortician Answers Dead Body Questions. Now, there's a heading that gets right to it. And over 25 million people viewed that. His name is Victor M. Sweeney.
If a person wearing contacts dies, does the mortician take them out? I typically remove contact lenses because those just get in the way of me doing what I need to do to set their features and provide a decent appearance for the family.
Victor M. Sweeney is a funeral director and mortician and undertaker in Warren, a northwestern Minnesota town of about 1,600 people. He works for the DuBois Family Funeral Home. I was fascinated with Victor's videos and his skillful ability to relate his job to his audience, his keen articulation. In a nutshell, he pulled his audience in to educate them on one of the most natural, though oft untalked about, subjects that for surely will happen to us all, death. Well, I met Victor at DuBois Funeral Home in Warren, Minnesota, around a little table. He was dressed in a vest. He had a crisp, white button-down shirt, brown slacks, shiny shoes, and a perfectly combed, coiffed hairdo with dark rimmed glasses. Let's go to that interview now.
I was born in suburban Detroit to move from a very populated area to, I mean, Bismarck is large by North Dakota standards, but much smaller than what I was used to. I remember we actually flew in for the first time, and I'd been used to airports and seeing cities and, you know, urban sprawl. And we flew into Bismarck, and I looked out of the window of the plane after seeing all fields, and there's a tiny blip of a town, and I couldn't see where the airport was, couldn't see the runway. I thought for sure we were going to be landing in a field. At any rate, Bismarck was where I spent most of my teenage years. It's where I met my wife. When I was in high school, my whole childhood, I'd been discerning the vocation of a priest. I'm a Catholic. I'd always wanted to be a priest. And so in high school, I started very seriously discerning this and doing a lot of soul searching, a lot of introspection, a lot of prayer. At a certain point, I realized that I was quite frankly just too selfish to be a priest. I like accolades too much. And so then I was left kind of floundering, wondering what in the world I was going to do with my life. I don't like math or business or science. I only really like talking to people. And I was given a book by my godfather called The Undertaking by Thomas Lynch. Lynch was a classmate of his. He's like, Victor, read this book. It's really interesting. And I read that book and I realized that being an undertaker is kind of that strange middle ground between being a person who is in the world and doing business and working with people, but also in this strange spiritual realm as well, right? There's a certain pastoral and emotional and sometimes I like to say like that there's this kind of shaman aspect. Like you do your work kind of in secret, kind of behind closed doors. You work with families in a really difficult time when maybe they're not able to think perfectly straight, and here you are, the one thinking straight. And so there was kind of this beautiful confluence of realizing I could have this somewhat priestly aspect to my work, but also make a living. And so then I got a job at a funeral home in Bismarck. I parlayed that into a job in Fargo-Moorhead, where I worked at Korsmo Funeral Home, and then went to mortuary school at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And then through the long and short of it, ended up here.
It's interesting to say that you got that book. I've heard of this book as well. I mean, that was a life-changing moment then in your life.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not like I read the book and instantly realized it. But there were also a lot of other things in my life leading up to that that kind of filled in the cracks, if you know what I mean. So I'd had 10 close family deaths in the span of 10 years before that. Or my parents' first child, a daughter, Kate, she died before I was born. And I as a kid, we'd always go to the cemetery every year, like clean off her grave, and we'd go and visit, and we'd visit my grandma, because she's buried in my grandma's town. So we always had this closeness with death in my family. Having the kind of historical and emotional backdrop, it seemed a very natural fit.
If you're just tuning in, this is the Great American Folk Show. I'm Tom Brousseau. We're in Warren, Minnesota, visiting with Victor Sweeney, who's a mortician and a funeral director. When did being a mortician kind of more or less just seem like a J-O-B?
It happens like that. It's funny because I kind of fluctuate back and forth. Sometimes it is just a J-O-B, right? Some days you come in the office and you're like, all right, fill in the paperwork, get someone dressed, put on their makeup, and it does become a little mechanical. And even sometimes when I'm working on a body, embalming them, preparing them, that becomes this kind of weird scientific rote activity sometimes. But then there are always moments that kind of draw you back and make a person realize why you do it. Let's say I'm draining blood from somebody to embalm them. And then I kind of set their features. I get their face, you know, and their expression the way it should be. And I recognize that person in an instant. Then they come back to me for a little bit. And you're like, ah, this is why I'm doing it. Because George looks like himself. And Marlis looks like herself. I was thinking about this, Tom. So you're a musician. You're an artist, right? And I was thinking about the word poetry. You probably know, right, in Greek, poetas is a maker. Right, so you're a maker. I've been kind of playing around with the idea as of late of using the term undertaker for myself more. You know, mortician is clinical and funeral director certainly sounds nicer, but I do kind of love the word undertaker in the same way that, you know, maker works for someone who's an artist, in that like an undertaker really does do a task that most people would rather not. And I think maybe leaning into that sometimes, even though maybe it's not as euphemistic as funeral director, I think really does speak to what I'm actually trying to do. You know, do a difficult task, not because it has to be done, but do a difficult task for a family because you want to and you love them and they might not be able to do it themselves.
Victor, I have a question for you just about the process of this profession. How has it changed in the last some years? How has it remained the same?
Well, I think fundamentally, funeral service doesn't really change. Even if we had a time machine, Tom, and you and I hopped in and we went 300 years into the future and ritual was entirely different, let's say. The fact is there would still be ritual. And humanity, you know, for whatever ritual changes, whatever history brings, I think our humanity doesn't change very much. I think we all have the same needs. We all have the same desire to be loved. We have the same desires to be remembered. And so I think that's really what funeral service and undertakers bring to the table, is we provide these events and opportunities to do that. I mean, I've seen our cremation rate continue to rise. That's always kind of the boogeyman of funeral service right now, is more people are burning their dead than burying them. But I've also seen, interestingly enough, where 10 years ago, most people would either think, okay, it's cremation or it's burial. There's a hard line between the two. What I'm seeing more of now is, even with families that are utilizing cremation, we often have like a family viewing or something at the funeral, where maybe we don't embalm mom or dad, but we clean them up and we get them dressed in their own clothes. We provide an opportunity for a family to come say goodbye in a setting that is, you know, pleasant, peaceful. And then likewise, I've seen families who might normally gravitate towards traditional burial in a casket with everything that entails, utilizing cremation as a way to simplify things. Or maybe we have a whole entire funeral with the casket and everything, and then we cremate at the end because mom's going to be buried somewhere far from here. I'm in my 10th year up here. Yeah, that desire for ritual and the creation of it, just, I couldn't overstate the value of that. It's so wildly important.
We've been visiting with Victor Sweeney here in Warren, Minnesota at the DuBois Funeral Home. Victor, thank you so much for being on the Great American Folk Show.
Thank you so much, Tom, for having me.
That you
That was Undertaker, Victor M. Sweeney. Thank you, Victor. You can see Victor's Wired produced videos online. They are educational and fantastic. It's everything that you didn't know that you wanted to know. Victor M. Sweeney. And this is the Great American Folk Show. The program has been eclectic today. My name is Tom Brusseau. Thank you for listening. Hope you have enjoyed our program. I was reading yesterday of the time when First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy helped bring over Da Vinci's famous Mona Lisa painting to the U.S. for viewing. I don't know if you heard about this. But the Mona Lisa did come to the United States, not for very long, just for a couple of weeks, and it was at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., and then at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Millions flocked to see it. Like I said, it wasn't here for long, about 6 weeks. And it was transported by ship from France to America on the SS France. And apparently it was secured, so tightly secured in a container and under guard. And the temperature was kept exactly precise. It did not stray even a half a degree for its entire voyage over here and then back to the Louvre. That was in 1963. It's the only time that the Mona Lisa painting ever came to the United States. And I was thinking about that. Because the Kennedy administration is often referred to as Camelot, the Kennedy-era White House. And it's a term used to describe something idyllic, good, and happy. And certainly, the First Lady made it that way. Apparently, Camelot was JFK's favorite musical, and it's mine, too. I just love this lyric. I've got to tell it to you while it's fresh in my mind. The rain may never fall till after sundown. By 8, the morning fog must disappear. In short, there's simply not a more congenial spot for happily ever after in than here in Camelot. You probably know this musical. Well, Camelot is the title of our next guest's record. Jennifer Castle is her name, and though within its grooves are songs different from those by Frederick Lowe and Alan J. Lerner, it still has that snap of fresh poetry with a dash of Peggy Seeger. Here's Fractal Canyon, and then Jennifer Castle will join us from Canada.
Out on the river where I go with my friends, they push cars off the banks. I take pictures where they landed. Dirt bikes are going by. Here's the echo laughing. Forest gnomes go dancing through the Fractal Canyon. And what's more, I could say anything. One door leads to another. Metronome. Or it would pack up. I don't know one from the other. All of the glory with none of the spending. I take part in the party that's never ending. Out the corner of your eye, you can see how I pretend. Pretend I'm not alone and let the memory bend. I'm with Paul, who's speaking in an Irish accent. Him and I wear tiger eye, and that's no accident. I take comfort in the stripe, the stone of protection. You can find me in my kitchen, I'll be breaking the dishes. Hello, Great American Folk Show, and thank you for having me. Happy New Year to everyone. I sent a short improvised version of a song, Merry Miracle, off my new record, Camelot, which on record is produced to be a big swinging song that is sort of ecstatic and faith-possessed, sort of Atari-esque and analog, but here is captured more as the kitchen table version, a sketch. At its core, a poetic rumination on miracles as insistent reminders that, as they say, God is good all of the time. This song was based on a memory I had of watching the news when I was a young girl in the early 80s, a segment on Mary statues crying blood in Italy and the Italian nonnas crowding around them shouting, "It's a miracle." As a little girl, it was so scary to see it. Dolls with blood on their face, and on the evening news, no less. It remained a haunting memory to me. I grew up to be fascinated at the idea of miracles being more than the happily ever after miracle of the feel-good movie variety, and more interested in the miracle gore of nature's insistence. The spectrum between a blood-crying statue near the Vatican and a school of spawning salmon thrusting themselves upstream against all odds. We're 12 days into 2025, and LA is on fire. On social media, my algorithm is serving stories of people finding unburned Mary statues in the rubble of the Palisades fire. It's serving photos of white crosses that are still standing pristine in the otherwise burnt landscape, and stories of residents of Altadena thanking God for sparing their lives while they stand in the ashes of their family homes. You see, since Merry Miracle, the song has been released onto the streaming platforms, people are tagging me with it and sharing it and playing it and shouting me out while doing it. Jennifer Castle, Merry Miracle. Jennifer Castle, Merry Miracle. So now, the ever-listening algorithm is continuing to search the world for miracles to show me, searching through the rubble of the news to find the most miraculous interpretations of current events, as if I'm a miracle junkie. And you know what, Great American Folk Show? Maybe I am. Okay. Happy New Year. Once again, sending my love from the cold, snowy shores of Lake Erie, through Fargo,
all the way to the people in LA and beyond who may be in need of a miracle today.
Mary, miracle, you cried blood down the cheeks of the non-believers. On the marble floor there came a flood. On the television was disbelief, and I want to know how you came to value the practice of dragging by the hair those pals who on their invisible crosses of their capitalist bosses who in the trash tossed out that have red beaten thought that all is not lost and that belief at all cost and Mary, miracle, you cried blood down the thighs of the porcelain angels. They're on the riverbed thrashing in the mud, yeah, swimming upstream against all odds like a scene of wild horses. All those natural forces that can be coerced by all this language of non-myth. Hate my life without it. It's just an opulent pageant of continuous non-death. I need that repeating thought that that all is not lost and that I believe at all cost and I really need that repeating thought that all is not lost and that believe at all cost and that believe at all cost and
and that's our show for today. My, how time just flies by. Thanks for listening. And thanks to our guests. You just heard a live session with Jennifer Castle. We began today with Jackson Pines, Evie Layden, Lynn Miles, and Victor M. Sweeney, my favorite mortician. Opening theme by Sean Watkins in Los Angeles, California. And theme by Brookham Boys in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Mary Jones is the talent producer all the way over there in Chicago. She joins the show every week. Elizabeth Brousseau helps out with the digital realm. Eric Dethridge is the editor and producer. Ann Alquist is the director. Support for the Great American Folk Show comes from the John and Elaine Andrus Charitable Trust, the estate of Blair Flegel, the Lorac family, First State Bank of Golva, and Minn Kota Power Cooperative. I'm Tom Brousseau. May you always find the sun until we meet again.